Friedrich Nietzsche was a German philosopher and a social critic, and evidently a person who appreciated wild mustaches. If anybody knows or heard of this man, they probably know him for the phrase that he coined, "God is dead." But what many people don't know is he was raised in a Christian home. His father was a Lutheran pastor, but he grew up to reject what he was raised in and to become one of the harshest critics of the time. And responding and reacting to what he saw as a cold and dead and joyless Christianity, he one time said, "I would only believe in a God who could dance." What an interesting phrase. He says, if God exists, I could only believe in him if he were a God who would dance. It's an interesting phrase. It has connotations of joy and of celebration. And I like what he is getting at here, especially as he was responding to what he saw as a dead, joyless, lifeless Christianity around him. But I would like to ask this question. What if God is dancing, but you don't want to join the celebration? What if God's heart is wild with celebration, but you refuse to dance? I want that quote from Nietzsche, as well as these questions, to be in our mind as we unpack the story that Jesus told. And we began last week in a study called The Embrace of God, looking at what was called the prodigal son. This is the story of the younger son who went away and then came back. And we noted last week that this story was prompted by the concern that religious leaders had. They saw Jesus welcoming sinners and eating with them. And they were concerned and maybe even scandalized because any self-respecting rabbi or man of God would not associate with those who were ungodly. And yet it seemed like the sinners, the misfits, the outcasts, those marginalized from society were flocking to see Jesus. And what's more, he was welcoming them. And so they were scandalized by that. So Jesus begins on the story. He said there's a man who had two sons, and the younger son had the audacious nerve to say to his father, "Give me my share of the inheritance." A statement that anyone would have recognized as saying, "I wish you were dead." And what is even more shocking than that request was the father actually gave him his share of the estate. And we're told that he went off and lived it up. He went out, sowed his oats, spent his money, had lots of fun in the process. But there was a famine that hit the land. And his money ran out, and he began to be in need. And so, as we saw in the scripture reading, he hired himself out to one of the citizens of this pagan land. And that master had him feeding the pigs. And as he was starving, looking at those pigs eating the slop the pigs eat, he longed to eat with them. And he began to come to his senses. And he said this. He devises this plan where he's going to go back and ask his father to receive him back. And this is the prepared speech he comes up with. "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants." And so we're told, as we just saw, that he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long ways off, his father saw him and felt not rage, not disgust, but compassion. And he ran and embraced him and kissed him. The son must have been stunned at this reception of his father. But he started in his prepared speech, and he said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But before he could get to that next phrase in his prepared speech, "Treat me as one of your hired servants," the father interrupts him, as it were. And he says to his servants, "Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand, shoes on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. And let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." And they began to celebrate. Two times in this passage, we're told that the father began to celebrate. And we noted that Jesus is telling us this story of why he's eating with these people who need him the most. Because God can't wait to celebrate. He rejoices when someone turns from their ways and follows the way of Jesus. And we made this note last week, that though we are all more flawed and broken and messed up, rebellious, addicted, lost, and yes, sinful, then we often have the courage to admit, Yet in Christ, we can experience more love, more forgiveness, more acceptance, more grace, and more celebration in the warm embrace of God the Father than we ever dared dream was possible. Our main line from last week was, the Father's embrace means there's always grace greater than our sin. And this is really the sticking point with the Pharisees, because they didn't think like Jesus. They didn't think that where sin abounds, grace abounds that much more. If I could maybe put some words in their mouth, it might go something like this. Our glare means grace is rare, especially when you sin. And so we're going to call our study today the parable of the lost sons. The younger son definitely was lost, and Jesus told the story about him, but that wasn't even the apex of the story. He's telling the story in response to the Pharisees who responded so cynically against him. And so the story continues. Verse 25. Now the older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. Here the older son is out doing what he's supposed to be doing, taking care of the father's land. And as he starts his way back to the house, he hears the sound of music and of dancing. There's a celebration going on, and no one has told him about it. And he doesn't know what's going on. This definitely wasn't on the schedule. And so he calls one of his servants and asks his servant, what does this mean? What's going on here? And he, that is the servant, said to him, your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound. Now, what do you think if you hadn't heard this story before? If you didn't know what the response of the older brother would be, what do you think it would be? Would this older son, who has his father's blood coursing through his veins, also have his father's heart? That father's heart that it can't wait to celebrate. That father's heart that would run and embrace the returning son. What's he going to do? It's interesting here. The servant told the older son, not, you know, Mr. Jones got his kid back and they're having a party. He says, your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf. I mean, he's emphasizing the family relationships here. Your brother, your father. How's he going to respond? We're told in verse 28 from Jesus, he was angry and he refused to go in. When you think of someone who is angry, what comes to your mind? As I listened to this story from Jesus and read it over and over over the last few weeks, I imagine the older brother clenching his fists at the sound that his brother was back and his father was celebrating. I imagine his jawline becoming stiff with his teeth clenched because his heart is now clenching. I imagine his eyes getting bigger, his face reddening, his nostrils flaring as he becomes angry that his brother's return and his father has thrown a celebration for him. Last week I mentioned a fellow named Henry Nguyen. He wrote a book called The Return of the Prodigal Son, and he had the opportunity to go and sit before this original masterpiece of Rembrandt called The Prodigal Son. It's 8 feet by 6 feet, and in St. Petersburg he had the opportunity to go and sit before this painting, and he spent hours and hours looking at it. And he would later write a book, and in it he said this, I became increasingly fascinated by the figure of the older son. I recall gazing at him for long periods and wondering what was going on in this man's mind and heart. At the time, when I was familiar only with the detail of the painting in which the father embraces his returning son, it was rather easy to perceive it as inviting, moving, and reassuring. But when I saw the whole painting, I quickly realized the complexity of the reunion. The main observer watching the father embracing his returning son appears very withdrawn. He looks at the father, but not with joy. He does not reach out, nor does he smile or express welcome. He simply stands there at the side of the platform, apparently not eager to come up, come higher up. It's true that the return is the central event of the painting. However, it is not situated at the physical center of the canvas. It takes place on the left side of the painting, while the tall, stern elder son dominates the right. There is a large open space separating the father and his elder son, a space that creates a tension, asking for resolution. What is going on inside this man? What will he do? And of course, this amazing masterpiece by Rembrandt has the son right there as the father is embracing him. But in the story, this is separated. And so we're told in verse 28 that he was angry and he refused to come in. As you think about this older son and what must be going on in his mind, what questions do you want to ask? What do you think is going on in his heart? Where is he? And this is an important point I want us to consider. What we must see is that not only did the younger son get lost in his appetite for sensuality, but also the older brother is now lost in his anger and self-righteousness. Yes, the younger son went off to a far country, but now the older son is metaphorically off in a far country. He's refusing to come back to his father. He is just as lost as his younger sibling was. And so now the father has a situation on his hands. He had joy in his heart because his younger son had come home. They began to celebrate. He's probably anticipating the moment his older son returns to join the celebration that their family member has now come back. But perhaps that servant went in and said, "Your son, your oldest son, is now back, and he's refusing to come in. And by the way, he is really, really angry that you are throwing a party." So we're told by Jesus that the father came out and entreated him. The father, like the shepherd in the other story that Jesus told that leaves the 99 to go search for the one, now comes out, leaves the party to search for his older lost son. And we're told here that he entreats him. I find that to be very interesting. That word entreat in the original language simply means to call near, to beg or to urge or to encourage, to console, to invite or to summon. I find that to be a very interesting word because the father could have gone out to the older son and said, "Get your tail inside right now. I cannot believe you're making a scene. We should be celebrating right now. What is wrong with you?" And probably no one would have objected to the father telling him that. But that's not what the father does. The father comes out and entreats his son. He begs him. He urges him to come in. And why does he do this? Because if he just simply commanded his son to come in, his son probably would have obeyed, like he always does. He probably dutifully would have gone in, put on a fake smile, and welcomed his younger brother in and joined the party. But if he had done that, his father would have had an older son there in the party whose heart is still far away. So he's entreating his son to come out. And Jesus tells us that as he's entreating him, there's this conjunction, the word but. And as we read this, we're like, uh-oh, what comes next cannot be good. But he answered his father, "Look, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your command, and yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate." I read that kind of in just a flat voice there. Remember, he's angry. He is livid. Maybe he is shouting in his father's face, "Look, these many years I have served you. I have never disobeyed your command, and yet you have never given me a young goat that I might celebrate." Or maybe he does what I do when I get mad and I get really quiet and dialed in. "Look, these many years I have served you, and I have never disobeyed your commands, and yet you have never given me even a goat that I might celebrate." I can't even do justice to it. This guy is livid, right? And of course, when you're mad, you oftentimes put yourself in the very best light and the other person in the very worst light, right? These many years I have served you. I've never disobeyed you. Oh, come on. Even the best kids sometimes disobey. But right now, all he can see is how noble he is and how screwed up his father has made the situation. Yet you never. You see the resentment boiling up in him. You see the bitterness taking root. The NIV translates that phrase when he says, look, I've been serving you, as look, I have been slaving for you. That's entirely a legitimate translation. So what is Jesus getting at by painting the older son like this? Tim Keller, in his book, The Prodigal God, which I would highly commend to you, said this: do you realize then what Jesus is teaching? Neither son loved the father for himself. They both were using the father for their own self-centered ends rather than loving, enjoying, and serving him for his own sake. This means, he says, that you can rebel against God and be alienated from him either by breaking his rules or by keeping all of them diligently. It's a shocking message. Careful obedience to God's law may serve as a strategy for rebelling against God. You say, how can that be? How can a person who goes off and breaks all of God's law and the person who keeps all of God's law both be rebelling against him? Well, it's obvious, it's easy to see in the case of the younger son and what he did, but the older son is dutifully doing what he's doing because in his mind, to do this means his father is in debt to him. That his father owes him something. And so he says, look, these many years I have served you, I've never disobeyed your command, and yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate. But when this son of yours comes, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him. Can you hear the sarcasm in that? The disgust dripping from his lips? Philip Grand Ryken, in his commentary on this passage, said, the elder brother was completely lost. Lost in his refusal to reconcile, lost in his rejection of the father's joy, lost in his striving for self-salvation, lost in resentment for his brother's reward, and lost in the unrighteous desires of his own sinful heart. But he was lost mostly because he rejected his sonship, seeing himself as a slave instead of a son. He's looking at his father and thinks his father has gone crazy. He's looking at his son has gone crazy. This family he thought he had, they're distant from him, and he's distant from them, and he's fine with that at this moment. We're told in verse 31, the father says to him, his oldest son, son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. Son, he's reminding him that he is not a slave, but he is a son. He has full rights to the father's house. As the oldest son, he gets the majority of the inheritance. Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. No one said, could there be any greater statement of the father's commitment of love to him? Of the father's willingness to have him in his house with him. The father goes on and says, it was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. Remember when the older son said, when this son of yours who squandered your wealth, it's that distancing language we talk about in certain circles. It's like when one of my kids did something wrong and I'd come in and tell Heather about it. And I'm like, your son, Heather, did this. You know, I'm implying that it's not my son. And so we do that as parents. We do that in relationships with one another. But here the father presses this to him to reconnect his oldest son's heart with his younger son's heart. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother, your kin, your blood was dead and is alive, and he was lost and is found. So it's fitting to celebrate. That word fitting in the original language implies necessity, inevitability. Another translation puts it, we had to celebrate. This is entirely appropriate to celebrate because the brother was dead, and now he's alive. He was lost and is found. So, how's the older brother going to respond? Are these words from his father begging and pleading with him going to melt his heart? Let's see what the scriptures say. Wait a minute. That's the end of the story. That's the open-ended end of the story. We are meant to wonder how this older son responded to the father's heart that can't wait to celebrate. We're meant to put ourselves in the shoes or the sandals of that older son and ask the question, how would I respond in that situation? We don't know. All we know is the older son's heart is full of anger, comparison, bitterness, resentment, self-righteousness, and complaining. In other words, he is completely self-absorbed. And he can't celebrate because he knows nothing. He can't celebrate grace because he knows nothing about it. That's where we're left with. So did the father melt his heart? We don't know. We do know about the father's heart. What we know for certain is the father's heart, a heart that wants to have a joyful celebration with both of his sons. And so let's wrap up our time together in just a few points of application. The first one is this. Let's realize that this story invites us to see ourselves as the older lost sibling. I think for many of us, when we hear the story of the lost sons, naturally you can put ourselves in the category of the younger son. We love to be able to come back to the father and have him lavish his grace upon us. And that's certainly one way to think about this story. But I want to invite you to put yourself in the shoes of this older brother, to see yourself in the story, in the shoes of the older brother, and think about how you should respond or to think about how you ought to respond. I want to quote from Henri Nouwen once more. This is a little bit longer quote, but stick with me. He says, "It is hard for me to concede that this bitter, resentful, angry man might be closer to me in a spiritual way than the lustful younger brother. Yet the more I think about the elder son, the more I recognize myself in him. I have no difficulty identifying with the elder son of the parable who complained, 'All these years I have slaved for you, have never once disobeyed any of your orders. Yet you never offered me so much as a goat for me to celebrate with my friends.'" He goes on and says, "It is this lostness, characterized by judgment and condemnation, anger and resentment, bitterness and jealousy, that is so pernicious and so damaging to the human heart. Often we think of lostness in terms of actions that are quite visible, even spectacular. The younger son sinned in a way that we can easily identify. His lostness is quite evident. The lostness of the older son, however, is much harder to identify. He did all the right things. He was obedient, dutiful, law-abiding, hard-working. People respected him, admired him, praised him, and likely considered him a model son. Outwardly, the elder son was faultless. But when confronted by his father's joy at the return of his younger brother, a dark power erupts in him and boils to the surface. Suddenly, there becomes glaringly visible a resentful and proud, unkind, selfish person, one that had remained deeply hidden, even though it had been growing stronger and more powerful over the years. The more I reflected on the elder son in me, the more I realized how deeply rooted this form of lostness is and how hard it is to return home from there." And then he says this, "Returning home from a lustful escapade seems so much easier than returning home from a cold anger that has rooted itself in the deepest corners of my being. Can you see yourself in the older son? What can melt that heart, that cold heart? Remember Nietzsche, who said, I would only believe in a God who would dance? And we ask the question, what if God is dancing, but you don't want to join the celebration? What if God's heart is wild with celebration, but you refuse to dance? It's a question that needs to be asked, because the Pharisees would say, I would never believe in a God who would dance, especially if he's dancing with all the wrong kinds of people. Do you know how one way you can ask yourself, do I have the heart of the older son? Is simply to ask the question, what has happened to all your joy? I'm not saying you have to have a false kind of happy, clappy, Pollyanna approach to life. But a person whose heart is connected to the heart of God has a deep sense of joy, even in the midst of much sorrow. So what has happened to all your joy? Do you find yourself going through the motions of the Christian life? Do you do your duty? Do you read your Bible? Do you come to church? Do you give to the poor? But all the while, there's a coldness in your heart. There's a resentment because you think that God owes you more than he's given you. That you think that somehow God is holding out, that he's not paying attention to all your dutiful obedience. Why are you so defensive? Why are you so touchy? Why is it the slightest criticism wrecks your world? What has happened to all your joy? Henry Nouwen says, joy and resentment cannot coexist. If you believe that God is holding out on you, that he is not good to you, there can be no joy. And that's exactly where the older son found himself. That's exactly why the Pharisees and religious leaders were not at the table with Jesus welcoming sinners. So that's the first point of application. Let's see ourselves in light of that older son. But here's the second point. Let's believe that Jesus died for the sins of the sensualist and for the sins of the self-righteous. Let's believe that Jesus died for the sins of folks like the younger son, and that he died for the sins of people who are self-righteous, like the older son. Tim Keller, in that book I mentioned to you a while ago, The Prodigal God, had great insight. He said, Jesus does not divide the world into moral good guys and immoral bad guys. He shows us that everyone is dedicated to a project of self-salvation. We're just going about it in different ways. The son looked for salvation in going out and living it up and acting wild. The older son looked for salvation in being dutiful and keeping all the rules. Both of them were involved in a self-salvation project. Keller goes on. He says, this means that Jesus' message, which is the gospel, is a completely different spirituality. The gospel of Jesus is not religion or irreligion, morality or immorality, moralism or relativism, conservatism or liberalism. Nor is it something halfway along a spectrum between the two poles. It is something else altogether. What is that something else altogether? Let me answer that by referring to a time when C.S. Lewis went to a conference on world religions. And in one room, there is a seminar going on, and the question was, what, if anything, does Christianity offer to the world that's unique? And so there's a heated discussion going on about what it could be that Christianity offers, that nothing else does. And so C.S. Lewis walks in, and he sees all these people heated in an argument, and he asks the question, what's all the rumpus about? You have to imagine that in a good British voice. What's all the rumpus about? And so they told him, we're trying to figure out if there's anything unique about Christianity, what it offers to the world that nothing else does. And he responded by saying, oh, that's easy. It's grace. Grace. Glorious grace. The grace that the Father lavishes upon returning prodigals, as well as those who never leave home. My friends, may we be mesmerized by the glorious riches of His grace, which He lavishes upon us. And may we see ourselves, whether we are in a self-salvation project, living it up, or whether we're in a self-salvation project, trying to keep all the rules, that what Jesus offers us is a third way. Grace. That's what those religious leaders could not get. That's what was missing, and they couldn't figure out why Jesus would hang around with all the wrong kinds of people. Grace. Glorious grace. That's what makes Jesus unique.